world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. I'm Alan Barnes, and I live with my wife, Cindy, in Nashville, Tennessee, where I'm a lawyer and Cindy is a patient care coordinator for a plastic surgeon. We hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. The contenders for President of the United States duked it out last night in Cleveland.
We will talk with World's Jamie Dean about that ahead today on Washington Wednesday. Also, World Tour with news from around the globe and World founder Joel Bells on the mindset of debt.
It's Wednesday, September 30th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
It's time for the news. Here's Kent Covington.
President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden squared off last night in their first head-to-head debate.
Gentlemen, a lot of people have been waiting for this night, so let's get going.
Our Fox News Sunday host Chris Wallace heard there against the applause of a small, socially distanced crowd in Cleveland. Amid coronavirus safety measures, the candidates passed on the customary handshake, greeting one another from afar.
Looking forward to this, Mr. President.
Thank you, Joe.
But that was the last cordial exchange of the evening. The candidates argued on a range of topics, including the Supreme Court, health care, race relations, policing, and COVID-19. But the bitter tone of last night's debate often distracted from its substance, with both candidates descending into personal insults and name-calling.
Don't ever use the word smart with me. Don't ever use that word.
Oh, give me a break.
Because you know what? There's nothing smart about you, Joe.
Wait a minute. You get the final word, Mr.
Well, it's hard to get any word in with this clown.
Trump and Biden will face off again on October 15th. Vice President Mike Pence and Biden's running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, will meet for the one and only vice presidential debate 1 week from today. The ruler of Kuwait died on Tuesday. World's Anna Johansson has details.
State television in Kuwait reports that Sheikh Sabah al-Ahmad al-Sabah died Tuesday at the age of 91. The ruler drew on his decades as the oil-rich nation's top diplomat to push for closer ties to Iraq after the 1990 Gulf War and solutions to other regional crises. Sheikh Sabah assumed office as Kuwait's ruling emir in 2006 and became known for his diplomacy in the Middle East. He advocated for a peaceful resolution to a dispute between Qatar and other Arab nations that continues to this day. Kuwait has remained a staunch U.S. ally since the American-led war that ousted Iraqi troops from the country 30 years ago. Sheikh Sabah is expected to be succeeded by his half-brother, the Crown Prince Sheikh Nawaf al-Ahmad al-Sabah. Reporting for World, I'm Anna Johansson.
9 months into the global pandemic, the official worldwide death toll from COVID-19 has eclipsed the 1 million mark. That according to a tally from Johns Hopkins University. And that figure is almost certainly a vast undercount because of inadequate testing and reporting in some countries and concealment in others. Still, nearly 5,000 people die each day of COVID-19. New outbreaks are hitting parts of Europe, and experts fear a second wave in the United States, which accounts for more than 200,000 deaths. An American is facing possible prison time in Thailand for leaving negative hotel reviews online. World's Kristen Flavin has more.
Thailand has extremely tough, and critics charge unjust, defamation laws. Prosecutors have targeted labor activists, journalists, and whistleblowers for allegedly violating criminal defamation laws. And now, American expat Wesley Barnes, who teaches English in Thailand, faces several years in prison. That after he posted critical reviews online of the Sea View Koh Chang Hotel. The incident started with a dispute over a beverage fee, but Barnes claimed he also saw a manager treat a Thai employee abusively, and that's why he decided to post his critical reviews. The review he posted to TripAdvisor said, "Do not sleep here. Do not support modern-day slavery of Thai people." Later postings were similar in tone. Police arrested Barnes earlier this month. He spent 2 nights in jail before being freed on $3,000 bond. His next court date is October 6th. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
One day after Tampa Bay won its first NHL championship since 2004.
Time ticks down! The Lightning win the Stanley Cup! They've reached the top of the mountain!
The NBA Finals tip off tonight. LeBron James will lead the Lakers against a team he helped to win a pair of championships, the Miami Heat. The Lakers are favored to win their 17th championship behind two first-team All-NBA superstars, James and power forward Anthony Davis. But the Heat are not intimidated. Rookie Tyler Hero and second-year players Bam Adebayo and Duncan Robinson will lead a youth movement into the best-of-seven series. The teams will play the entire series inside the NBA bubble at Disney's Wide World of Sports in Orlando. Game 1 tips off at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on ABC. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, analysis of last night's presidential debate, plus Joel Bell's on our MasterCard mentality. This is The World and Everything in It. It's Wednesday, the 30th of September, 2020. You're listening to The World and Everything in It, and we are so glad you are. Good morning. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. First up, the first presidential debate.
What a night.
It sure was. 90 minutes of, shall we say, pointed discussions about the Supreme Court, healthcare, the economy, and of course, COVID-19. Lots to dive into. And joining us to unpack the rhetorical jousting is Jamie Dean. She's World's national editor and chief political correspondent. Good morning to you, Jamie.
Good morning, Mary.
Well, what were you looking for going into last night?
Well, you know, President Trump went into the debate last night as the presumable underdog, at least according to a string of recent polls showing him trailing Joe Biden. You know, polls have also reported an overwhelming majority of voters have already made up their minds about the candidate they'll choose. So I think the question for Trump going into the evening was, could he do something to change that dynamic? Would he have a compelling, clear message that would win over the slice of voters that aren't yet decided? When it comes to former Vice President Joe Biden, Biden hasn't had to appear in many unscripted encounters this year. It's not been a traditional campaign season, and he's often been able to deliver prepared remarks without a lot of off-the-cuff exchanges we usually see on the stump. You know, he's verbally stumbled in some of his public appearances. So, you know, how would Biden do? Would he seem fit and ready to take on the job of the presidency? And finally, and perhaps most importantly, what would the candidates have to say? I mean, what might we learn about actual policy?
Right. But before we get to the answers to those questions, set the stage for us a bit. Tell us about the parameters for this debate.
You know, the candidates debated in an auditorium at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. Chris Wallace of Fox News moderated. And though Fox is known as a conservative network, Wallace is known for holding Trump's feet to the fire. So this didn't promise to be an easy stroll for Trump.
And what were the topics?
Well, the idea was to have six 15-minute segments focusing on a single topic in each segment: the pandemic, the economy, the Supreme Court, the candidates' records, election integrity, and race and violence in American cities. And I'll admit, when I saw this list, I thought, you know, those are big topics to cover in 15-minute chunks. But that's how Wallace set the table for the evening.
Okay, let's get to the main course now. What were your main takeaways?
Well, you know, it's hard to know where to begin, but I think it was really a pretty miserable evening all around. I had to go back to my notes to try to find the threads that emerged over the course of the debate because it was quite hard to follow at points. The candidates spoke over each other so much, the moderator had to plead with them to stop. And President Trump certainly had the hardest time not interrupting his opponent. Chris Wallace ended up telling him, "I think the country would be better served if they could hear from both of you without interruptions." But, you know, beyond the interruptions, it just went low. I mean, Trump said there was nothing smart about Biden. Biden called Trump a fool. It seemed like the dynamic reflected so much of the division and rancor in the country right now, when, you know, what we need are leaders who can model how to talk with people who we disagree with in ways that are respectful and productive. I certainly don't think we saw that happen last night. So in many ways, I found it to be a sad moment after such a long year.
Did we learn anything about policy?
Well, you know, I think this debate was more about personality than policy in a lot of ways. And it was hit or miss when it came to hearing nitty-gritty details about what the candidates would actually do. A couple of things jumped out at me. On the Supreme Court, I think we got a glimpse of Biden's strategy when it comes to the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. You know, he did not go after her personally, and he first emphasized how the court might handle the Affordable Care Act in the coming weeks. So Biden narrowed in on an issue that he probably thinks is in the forefront of many voters' minds right now. He did go on to mention Roe v. Wade and said that would be an issue too, but that was not his first line of offense.
And Jamie, what about the notion of expanding the Supreme Court if Trump goes ahead with Barrett's confirmation against Democrats' wishes?
Well, that's something the Democrats have floated. You know, some have said if Trump pushes ahead, we should add justices to the court if we win the election. You know, Biden in the past has said he's against that idea, but he really dodged the question when Wallace directly asked him what he would do. Here's that exchange.
Are you willing to tell the American people tonight whether or not you will support either ending the filibuster or packing the court?
Whatever position I take on that, that'll become the issue. The issue is the American people should speak.
So that's significant. He's not pledging to resist court packing, and he's not ruling out eliminating the Senate filibuster, which is something else he has said in the past he didn't think we should do. So that opens the possibility of an expanded Supreme Court and a Senate that could pass legislation with a simple majority instead of a 60-vote threshold. I thought that was a significant moment.
And how did Trump respond?
You know, overall, I think the president tried to tie Joe Biden to the far left of his party. And a lot of people have raised questions about how far left Biden would be willing to go since he has moved to the left on some policies already. You know, and this is where Biden said something I thought was really interesting.
I am the Democratic Party right now.
And that was an intriguing statement. I am the Democratic Party. You know, I think what he's trying to say there is, you know, don't worry about those who are to the left of me. And Trump is trying to keep those people on the left in front of voters' minds because they do have an influence on Biden.
Okay. And then what did they have to say about the handling of the pandemic?
Well, this got into a lot of back and forth about whether Trump acted soon enough in handling the pandemic and whether Biden would have done better. I think maybe the more pressing question of the evening for a lot of voters is what would the candidates do now? You know, on this point, I think the president tried to plant a flag about what he thinks Biden would do if the pandemic worsens again. Trump actually talked about this during the segment on the economy, but I think it's safe to say there was a lot of overlap in topics all night. Here's what he said on this.
And he wants to close down he will shut it down again. He will destroy this country.
You know, that's a message I think Trump wanted to land, especially for voters concerned about a return to lockdowns.
Well, there was also a discussion about race in America and some of the recent riots, right?
Right. And here is where Chris Wallace pressed Biden on whether he had called on the mayors of cities in Oregon to allow the National Guard to come in and help quell the ongoing riots in those cities.
Have you ever called the Democratic mayor of Portland or the Democratic governor of Oregon and said, hey, you got to stop this, bring in the National Guard, do whatever it takes, but you stop the days and months of violence in Portland?
I don't hold public office now. I am a former vice president. I've made it clear in my public statements that the violence should be prosecuted. It should be prosecuted. And anyone who commits it should be prosecuted.
But you've never called for the people, the leader, excuse me, sir. You have never called for the leaders in Portland and in Oregon to call and bring in the National Guard and knock off 100 days of riots.
They can, in fact, take care of it if he just stay out of the way.
Oh, really?
So I think this was a weak spot for Biden. I mean, if voters are concerned about how he would handle rioting and unrest in American cities, I'm not sure they heard the answer there. Now, President Trump was very insistent in saying we need law and order, and he tried to paint Biden as less enthusiastic about that. But Trump faced his own moment of dodging an important question when Wallace asked him about whether he would condemn white supremacy.
The vice president for not specifically calling out Antifa and other left-wing extremist groups. But are you willing tonight to condemn white supremacists and militia groups, sure, and to say that they need to stand down and not add to the violence in a number of these cities, as we saw in Kenosha and as we've seen in Portland.
Sure,
are you
I'm
prepared
to
specifically
that,
do it?
Well, I would say almost everything I see is from the left wing, not from the right wing.
So what are you saying?
I'm willing to do anything. I want to see peace.
Then do it, sir.
Say it.
Do you want to call them? What do you want to call them? Give me a name.
White supremacists and
right wing. Who would you like me to condemn?
White supremacists and right wing.
Proud Boys. Stand back and stand by, but I'll tell you what, somebody's got to do something about Antifa and the left, because this is not a right-wing problem. This is a
left-wing.
This is a left-wing problem.
You know, that's a moment where it's hard to understand why the president wouldn't just say, of course I condemn white supremacy. You know, even if he thinks leftist groups are more responsible for the riots going on in American cities, and even if that's the point he wants to make, it would still be simple and wise to say, yes, I condemn white supremacy.
After a discussion on climate change, Wallace ended the debate by asking the candidates if they would pledge not to declare victory until after the election is independently verified. What did they have to say on that question, Jamie?
Well, Trump expressed his concerns over mail-in voting, and I think he was trying to emphasize how overwhelmed the voting systems might become when they receive an unprecedented number of mail-in ballots over the next few weeks. And that's a valid concern, and it could mean we end up waiting a few days or even weeks to learn the outcome of the election if it comes down to a close count in a swing state. And Trump also talked about reports of mishandled ballots and his concern that there is fraud in the system. Biden kept it pretty simple when he spoke about voting, and I think this might have been one of his strongest moments of the night. You know, he spoke directly to American voters and reminded them about the opportunity in front of them.
Show up and vote. You will determine the outcome of this election. Vote, vote, vote.
So, Jamie, overall, would you say there was a winner or a loser?
Well, I don't think there was a winner. I think the debate was way too uncivil to think of one candidate as triumphing. I do think Biden showed he could hang in there with Trump and make the points he wanted to make. I think Trump showed he was digging in and reaching out to his base. I'm not sure that either candidate would have won over voters who were undecided after tonight, but they do get two more chances. We've got two more presidential debates coming up in October.
We do indeed. Jamie Dean is World's National Editor and Chief Political Correspondent. Thanks so much, Jamie.
You're welcome, Mary.
Additional support comes from Dort University, providing an education rooted in faith for engineers, nurses, social workers, teachers, and more. More at dort.edu.
Say you're walking along a familiar path. You look down and notice something unfamiliar. Well, that was the case for a man in Arkansas over Labor Day, exploring a park he had enjoyed since he was a kid. Something shiny caught his eye. He thought it might have just been glass, but, you know, I left out probably an important detail. This was not any old state park. This was the Crater of Diamonds State Park.
Uh-huh.
And you couldn't blame him for wanting to be certain about this. It took a little time, but workers in the park did confirm it was a diamond, a 9-carat diamond, really big. This thing could fetch $100,000 or more. Now, this state park, it's unique. It's truly finders keepers. Locating diamonds is the point. And in the 50 years the park's been open to the public, explorers have found more than 30,000 diamonds and only one bigger than this one. Now, you had to know there was a kicker. The finder is going to be hearing from the IRS. Bad news here. Even if he doesn't sell it, Uncle Sam will be demanding a cut.
Of course.
It's the world and everything in it. Today is Wednesday, September 30th. This is World Radio. Thanks for joining us today. Good morning. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, World Tour with Africa reporter Onize Ohikere.
We start today in the Middle East. Violence in Afghanistan continues to rise despite ongoing peace talks between the government and the Taliban. Afghan forces launched an airstrike earlier this month, killing Taliban fighters and dozens of civilians. A day later, Taliban forces attacked security checkpoints, killing 24 Afghan soldiers. Both sides blame each other for the rising violence. Almost 100 civilians have died during the past 2 weeks, even as government officials and Taliban representatives discuss a vision for a united Afghanistan. Abdullah Abdullah is a key negotiator in the peace talks.
At the moment, unfortunately, the level of violence is very high. The number of security incidents emanated by the Taliban in different parts of the country has increased, not decreased.
Some analysts aren't surprised. They expected the Taliban to increase attacks during peace talks using the show of strength as a negotiating tactic. The United States brokered a deal with the Taliban 6 months ago to launch the peace talks. Washington promised to withdraw its troops from the country, and Afghanistan vowed to release 5,000 jailed Taliban fighters. In exchange, the militants promised to release 1,000 Afghan troops and cut ties with Al-Qaeda and other terror groups. But so far, the Taliban has failed to follow through on several key promises. It continues to work with Al-Qaeda and has only released about 250 Afghan soldiers. So far, the two sides have only discussed the framework for how to negotiate. Officials say they have resolved most procedural issues, but they're stuck on which school of Islamic thought they will use to resolve disputes.
Both sides come from two different worldviews, views about the life, about rights of citizens. About
the Afghan government hopes to preserve civil and democratic rights, while the Taliban could push for strictly enforcing Islamic rule. Next, we go to Europe.
Es braucht einen Standort mit der bestmöglichen Sicherheit.
Germany is looking for a site to store its radioactive nuclear waste. The nation's waste management organization issued a report on Monday listing 90 different sites that are geographically suited to storing the material. After Japan's Fukushima nuclear disaster in 2011, Germany decided to phase out its nuclear power generation. But the country is still trying to decide what to do with all the leftover waste. Officials are looking for a site that can house almost 2,000 containers of the material for 1 million years. Authorities aim to reach a decision by 2031 and to begin using the site in 2050. Next, we go to Africa.
Actually, it has been quite catastrophic, if I may.
Sudan has declared an economic state of emergency.
Last July, inflation was at 144%. In August, it was almost 167%.
The country's inflation rate is at a record high. The prices of staple goods have skyrocketed. Beef has almost doubled in cost, and the price of bread and sugar has increased by 50% over the past few weeks. Many Sudanese blame the government for the economic downturn. In April, the government raised the minimum wage from 245 Sudanese pounds to 3,000. Critics say the government funded the new policy by simply printing more money, driving up inflation. Devastating summer floods also wiped out crops. 10 million people in the country currently face severe food shortages.
Et pour les sages conseils que le médiateur,
next, we go to Mali.
Son Excellence Goodluck Jonathan n'a cessé de prodiguer à ce prêtre.
An interim president took the oath of office on Friday, 5 weeks after the military ousted the country's previous leader. Last month's coup toppled the government after weeks of protests and unrest. The military leaders appointed the interim president as part of the transition to civilian rule. He swore to honor international accords and crack down on the Islamist insurgency. Mali has been in upheaval since a 2012 uprising. Jihadists remain active in the area, and the violence has claimed thousands of civilian lives. That conflict, coupled with government corruption and a weak economy, led to mass protests against the previous president. It all culminated in last month's military coup. The interim president will hold power for up to 18 months before the next election. And finally, we end today in Asia. A rat has won an award for saving lives in Cambodia. Magawa is an African pouched rat trained to sniff out landmines. Decades of conflict have left Cambodia littered with millions of explosives. The leftover landmines kill or injure dozens of people every year. An organization trained Magawa and rats like him to sniff out the TNT in unexploded bombs.
They're completely depending on their sense of smell and hearing. And if you look at them, they're sniffing all the time.
Because the rodents are small, they don't trigger the landmines. Magawa has discovered 67 explosives in the past 7 years. And he can clear an area the size of a tennis court in half an hour. A human with a metal detector might take 4 days to clear that much space. That's this week's World Tour. Reporting for World, I'm Onize Ohikere in Abuja, Nigeria.
Today is Wednesday, September 30th. Good morning to you. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Nick Eichert.
And I'm Mary Reichard. World founder Joel Bells makes the connection between an unhealthy mindset and debt.
I finally found some common ground. Not quite what I was looking for, but as best I can tell it, it's an issue Republicans and Democrats agree on. But they do it in silence. The topic is debt retirement. It's a current issue because here in the United States, we've just taken on some $3 trillion in brand new debt. That's $13,000 in new debt for every man, woman, and child. Add that to the $100,000 already owed by every individual coming into this most bizarre era. The sober fact is that we as a nation approach this tough fiscal assignment with a credit card mentality. We are a people unable to defer the gratification of our desires. By and large, we live in homes that are nicer than our parents had at the same age. The same is true for our cars, our clothes, use of leisure time, travel and vacations, and everything that drives our family budgets up, up, and up. We Christians are, in this regard, virtually indistinguishable from the society we live in. And by blending in with our surroundings, we are missing a strategic opportunity for witness to a key element of the gospel. Christians of all people should understand that the MasterCard mentality is not the way to master life. The pattern Jesus established was one of deferring desires, not because the fulfillment of desire is wrong, but because, as Jesus said, "My time has not yet come." Most of us think our time has come 5 minutes after the desire first pops into our minds. Yet few concepts are more central to a Christian way of thinking than the ideal of deferring a present desire, in the confidence that something richer lies down the road. It is a constant and unrelenting theme of Scripture. The principle is everywhere except in our consumer consciousness. There, the infection still rages, and that is costly in two ways. First, wasted resources. We spend far more than we should on interest, carrying charges, and fees. We would literally have 50% more to spend on what we want, maybe even more, if we were patient to wait until the resources were here. Think what impact that might have on the underfinanced ministries of God's kingdom. And second, it is costly in terms of a wasted witness. If Christians were known around the world as people who, through their patience, thrift, and keen sense of priorities, lived prosperous lives, the gospel they preach and teach would have more credibility than it does now, when so many of us spend most of our years playing catch-up with the finance companies. As it stands, our political leaders from both parties have nothing but silence when it's suggested that such basic principles of finance be applied to the nation's astonishing debt. And their silence is becoming more and more deafening. I'm Joel Bills.
Coming tomorrow, land mismanagement. We'll find out how policies have contributed to the intensity of the fires now plaguing the West Coast. And we'll have an update on the unrest in Belarus. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. Writing of Abraham, the Apostle Paul wrote, "No unbelief made him waver concerning the promise of God. He grew strong in his faith as he gave glory to God, fully convinced that God was able to do what he had promised." I hope you'll have a great rest of the day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.